Hello, and welcome in to another episode of the Big Ten Blitz. As always, I'm your host, Sean, and it was a terrific Week 11 across the best conference in college sports. On Friday night, UCLA picked up their third straight win, upsetting Iowa 20-17 at home. To get things started on Saturday, Ohio State blanked Purdue 45-0. Oregon moved to 10-0, beating Maryland 39-18 at home. Penn State really showed up for the White House, absolutely dominated Washington from end to end, beat them 35-6. Rutgers stopped their losing ways and beat the surging Gophers 26-19. Even without Kyle Manungai, really rode the back of a strong defensive performance in a great game by Ethan Calliope-Manis. And then what was the game of the week across the Big Ten? Michigan traveling to Indiana. The Hoosiers moved to 10-0 for the first time in school history, held on to beat Michigan 20-15. And that is the game that I want to start with today. I will talk about Indiana in a little bit, have a lot to cover with them. Really proud of Kurt Cignetti and everything he's accomplished in Indiana his first season. It seems like he is just one win away from securing a spot in the first 12-team college football playoff, which is absolutely ridiculous to think about. But before I get to Indiana, we have to lament on what's going on in Michigan a little bit, because they are really at a crossroads now. They sit at 5-5, have a bye week to get ready for their final two games, which are Northwestern and Ohio State. And the reality is, Michigan is staring down the barrel of a 6-6 football season. I don't care what happened to you in the offseason, that your coach left, that you lost 20 seniors, that you lost a first-round quarterback, that you're going through this cheating scandal, all that. I don't care what happens to you in the offseason. Going from undefeated national champion one season to 6-6 the next season is not normal, especially for a program as storied and as rich as Michigan. I think back to Auburn in 2010 when they went undefeated and won the national championship, where Cam Newton and Nick Fairley really carried that entire team. That was not a good roster. That was not a particularly well-coached team. They had maybe the most dominant offensive player in the history of the sport that really got them to that national championship. And even them, after they lost those two players and a boatload of seniors also, in 2011, even that Auburn team managed to win 8 games. So I don't want to hear from Michigan fans that this was to be expected. This is what happens when you lose your head coach. Going 6-6 the year after winning a national championship is alarming and should not be tolerated at Michigan, which brings up the question, what's next for Michigan? Does Sherrone Moore deserve more time? Has he earned the opportunity to return to Ann Arbor for another season to prove that he is going to be the one to carry Michigan in the post-Harbaugh era? Or is it about time that Michigan begins prep for a new head coaching search? Before the season started, every Michigan fan was saying, we understand this is going to be a tough season, but we are going to ride and die with Sherrone Moore. He is our leader. He is the guy, and he can bring us back to the promised land. And as weeks have gone by, the number of Michigan fans beating their chest defending Sherrone Moore has shrunk, and now it almost seems like the majority would be in favor of moving on from Sherrone Moore. But I wanted to look at it as, what has Sherrone Moore accomplished? Let's look at his body of work since he was hired as the head coach and evaluate what the job he's done at Michigan. And I broke it down into 4 kind of barrels. First off, his in-game management and game prep, his ability to get his team ready for games every week. Second, building his coaching staff. Third, player development. And fourth, recruitment. So let's go through those 4 categories and really see how has Sherrone Moore performed. So first, in-game management and game prep. I think that game against Indiana was pretty much a showcase of what's been going on at Michigan all year long, and that is just some really poor in-game coaching decisions. We can start at the end of the game where Michigan was on defense, had 3 timeouts left, had to force a 3-and-out in order to get the ball back to have a chance at winning the game. Indiana ran the ball for 8 yards on first down, and then Michigan inexplicably let the play clock run for 30 seconds before calling their next time out. Indiana ended up getting that first down anyway, so it didn't really matter, but just waiting 30 seconds to call one of your timeouts that you need to use in order to get the ball back is just an inexplicably dumb decision by Sherrone Moore and that coaching staff. No excuse for that. But it didn't stop there. For the 2nd straight week, Sherrone Moore wasted his challenge and wasted a timeout on a play call that seemed very obvious. Last week against Oregon, it was an incomplete catch that he challenged, saying that the receiver did catch it when it was clear he was out of bounds. This week, Alex Orji fumbled the ball. It was clear live, and it was clear on every angle of the replay that he was standing up when that ball came out. But Sherrone Moore decided to throw the challenge flag and lost the timeout because of that. So that's now 2 instances in the past 2 weeks of just really poor, idiotic challenges. And then to start the second half, Michigan had 3rd and 7 in Indiana territory. They ran the ball, make it 4th and 3 at just outside the Indiana 40-yard line. And then they just take an intentional delay of game and punt it. If you were never going to go for it on 4th down, why'd you run the ball on 3rd and 7? It's just another silly decision. And another point in the game, Michigan had 1st and goal at the Indiana 10. They ran it 3 straight times, had 4th and goal at the 3, down 17-3. A field goal doesn't do you a whole lot of good. Still is a 2-possession game. Instead of trying to go for it to make it a 17-10 game. And at worst, if you don't get it, you pin them back really deep. And their Michigan's defense was playing well in that second half. But no, they take a chip shot field goal, make it 17-6. Which even the announcers, when that play happened, they were like, what exactly are they thinking? And then I go back to the Oregon game again last week, where they had that trick play on 4th down right outside Oregon's end zone, where they needed to score a touchdown in order to stay in that game. And they opted for a trick play on a throwback to Orji in the end zone that was so poorly thrown that Alex Orji ended up running into a camera. It was just at that point, Davis Warren had been playing pretty well against Oregon, and they take the ball out of his hands and have someone throw it to their quarterback. There really has been week over week a pattern of bad decisions, whether it's poor clock management, 4th down decisions, not understanding the rules, and things of that nature that have just stacked up and have really cost Michigan in key moments. And I think of Dan Lanning at Oregon has gotten so much praise for a lot of instances of really expertise coaching, whether it would be that 12th man incident against Ohio State or against Michigan, where they brought out that weird punt formation, which led to Michigan covering up the snapper, which led to an automatic 1st down, or his fake punt that he ran in his own territory against Maryland this past weekend. Dan Lanning has showed out why he really is one of the best coaches in all of college football, and Sharon Moore has done the exact opposite to hurt his team and show that he really is out of his element with his in-game management. And I think this doesn't just apply to play calls or 4th down decisions or challenges. It also applies to really their offensive struggles as a whole. I completely understand that Michigan just has flat out bad quarterbacks. They don't have a quarterback that probably could start at any other Big Ten school right now. But Alex Orji has been with the program for 3 years now, and all they can do with him is quarterback powers. He can't complete a screen. He can't run a speed option. They don't even trust him to throw a shovel pass. He got 3 touches against Indiana. All of them were straight runs right up the middle that everyone in the stadium could have predicted. And on one of them, the one where he did fumble, where Sharon Moore wasted his challenge on, 3 Hoosiers met him in the backfield before he got to the line of scrimmage, and he fumbled that ball. And this is right after Indiana handed Michigan good field position by going for it on a questionable 4th down. Also, I don't understand how they're utilizing the guys in this offense. I don't believe that Alex Orji is simply incapable of effectively running a few gadget plays or maybe even running an offense. I think the fact that he hasn't been able to develop beyond a glorified wildcat running back in his 3 years at Michigan falls squarely on the coaching staff in their lack of ability to develop him into a real quarterback. Because listen, Alex Orji is a really great athlete. Khalil Mullings and Donovan Edwards are not an easy backfield duo to tackle. Colston Loveland is the best tight end in college football, I think by a fairly wide margin. This offense has weapons. There are pieces to make this offense at least semi-competent. But Sharon Moore, who is an offensive guy who has his fingerprints all over this offense, does absolutely nothing to try to get the ball in his playmakers in creative ways. On the first 2 plays of the game, they had Colston Loveland lined up as a wide receiver, and he got open, he made a catch, made a couple moves, and got him a couple 1st downs to get that game started, and then he had 2 catches the rest of the game. When you have a weapon like Colston Loveland, you should be trying to find ways to force-feed him the ball. And when you have guys like Khalil Mullings and Donovan Edwards who can be a force in the open field, yet they're not catching any passes whatsoever, it just really makes you question, you know, what exactly is your game plan here with this offense? So I think it's clear that Sharon Moore needs help, like he needs a better offensive coordinator. But at the same time, Sharon Moore made all of these hiring decisions, which brings me into the next bucket, which is building your coaching staff. And I had my concerns about Michigan's coaching staff coming into the season. And as the weeks have gone by, I feel like I've just continued to be proven right about the concerns I had about some of the hires Sharon Moore made. First and foremost, Kurt Campbell. I never understood that hire. He was with Michigan for 2 years before Sharon Moore promoted him to offensive coordinator. 1 year was as an analyst and the other was as the quarterback's coach, but he was really given JJ McCarthy. I don't think anyone can claim that Kurt Campbell developed McCarthy. And before those 2 years at Michigan, Kurt Campbell's most notable experience was as an analyst at Penn State, and then 2 years as the offensive coordinator at Old Dominion. And Old Dominion's offense actually got worse in Kurt Campbell's second year with them, and they ended up firing him mid-season. And after he left, Old Dominion ended up going on a 4 or 5 game win streak to get to a bowl game late in the season. That was his biggest experience, and Sherrone Moore looked at him and said, yeah, you look like the kind of guy that can run this offense. And some other decisions. They took Tony Alford from Ohio State, their running backs coach. But I think if you asked an Ohio State fan, which of your skill position coaches are you okay giving up? I feel like Tony Alford would have been the first one out of their mouths. And then look what happened. Ohio State got Quinshon Judkins after Tony Alford left. Ohio State is one of the best running teams in all of college football. Meanwhile, Michigan's running back production has tanked under Tony Alford. Ron Bellamy, as their pass game coordinator, he was a high school coach for 11 years, then spent 2 seasons as Michigan's safeties and wide receivers coach, and then Sherrone Moore promotes him to passing game coordinator. Don Martindale is their defensive coordinator after he was fired from the New York Giants, and then Sherrone Moore kept on Chris Partridge, as well as a lot of other coaches that were named in this Connor Stallions investigation. They ended up having to fire Chris Partridge, who is their linebackers coach, because of that investigation. Seems to me that Sherrone Moore just had blind faith in the coaches that were left over that weren't brought with Harbaugh to the Los Angeles Chargers. Seemed like he just had blind faith in them, said, yeah, this is good enough. We don't have to go out and interview guys from outside of this building. We don't need to try to make a splash hire. We're good with what we have. He didn't bring in any high-profile guys, hardly considered anyone from outside the program. And I feel like almost every single hiring decision has been a flop so far. I think the details and lack of mistakes that we became so used to with Michigan under Jim Harbaugh has gone out the window, and now the defining characteristic of Michigan on both sides of the football is that they make pretty silly mistakes. And again, that falls squarely on Sherrone Moore and the coaching staff that he hired around him. Third, player development. I already talked about the quarterbacks and how they are just simply not getting developed. They have simply the worst quarterback room in college football, with virtually no improvement over the career. If you look at Alex Orji, if you look at Davis Warren, Jack Tuttle, none of those guys have really improved since being at Michigan. Donovan Edwards, his productivity has stunted and has gone from cover of College Football 25 to second string on his own team. The wide receiver position has always been a position of weakness, and that's only gotten worse. Blah. And then their offensive line, which was really the linchpin of this entire team, all of a sudden they don't have 6 super seniors to rely on, and they look lost. Routinely, their pocket is collapsing when only having to block 3 or 4 guys. And then you look on the defensive side of the ball, the young guys on this defense just are not stepping up like you've been used to seeing under Jim Harbaugh. Jayshon Barham was a great talent they brought in from Maryland. He's playing the worst football I've seen him play out of his 3 years so far. The defensive line, other than Kenneth Grant and Josiah Stewart, really not stepping up very much and playing well. The entire secondary, outside of Will Johnson, who hasn't played in over a month now, consistently gets beat in one-on-one coverage. There just isn't a whole lot you can point to in any of these position groups, or very many players at all, who have grown this season, who make you feel optimistic about the future of Michigan. There aren't many young players we've seen out there who make you feel like this Michigan team is on an upward trajectory that makes you get excited about the future. When players aren't developing, when players aren't improving over the course of a season or over the course of their career, that's on the coaches, and once again, falls on Sherrone Moore. Then finally, recruitment. To Sherrone Moore's credit, recruitment for Michigan has gotten a lot better after a quiet couple months to the start of his tenure. They've gotten 4 commitments in the past 3 weeks. They're now a consensus top 20 class. They're going after Bryce Underwood, that number one quarterback in the 2025 recruiting class, who could be trending towards Michigan after that Alabama versus LSU game. But also, I think the commitments that they've gotten and this talk about Bryce Underwood is directly related to NIL talk. And it all started with Dave Portnoy a couple months ago saying that he is putting his foot down, he's creating a fund to help Michigan go get a better quarterback. And with that, the NIL talk around Michigan has skyrocketed. They've gotten a lot more donations, and they've gotten these commitments. And again, that conversation started with Dave Portnoy, not Sherrone Moore. I think the argument could be made that the president of Barstool Sports has had a bigger impact on the recruiting trail than Sherrone Moore has. So I don't want to say Sherrone Moore has been a complete failure on the recruiting front when Michigan's currently sitting with a 12th rated class or so, depending on what rankings you're looking at. But seeing how the recruitment has unfolded over the past 8 months or so doesn't make me entirely confident that Sherrone Moore can keep this up and bring in the best talent and then develop them and make them better players that can go out and form a team like we saw from Michigan last year. To sum up, you really can't point to anything Sherrone Moore has done as head coach that gives you a lot of confidence that this Michigan program is heading in the right direction. But it's important you say nothing he's done as head coach, because so many Michigan fans want to hang their caps on what Sherrone Moore was able to do when taking over for those game days when Jim Harbaugh was suspended last season. But what people seem to have a hard time grasping about that is that Jim Harbaugh was with the team through the week, had them ready for game day. Sherrone Moore just kept the lights on while Jim Harbaugh wasn't allowed to be on the sideline with them during a few games. It's still impressive what he did. It's still impressive the kind of leadership he displayed, but that by no means qualifies him as the long-term solution as Michigan's head coach. Because guess what? Jim Harbaugh isn't there anymore to babysit him, to let him know what he needs to do, to get the team ready during the week. It's all Sherrone Moore now. And I usually don't want to rush to judgment. Usually I want to give coaches the benefit of the doubt. I want to give them the time to build their programs, get their players in there before calling them a failure. But the whole idea about keeping Sherrone Moore here was that Michigan won't have to go through a big change. They don't need to go through a regime change, a scheme change on either side of the football. This was supposed to be a continuation of what we saw from Jim Harbaugh. And for Sherrone Moore, this was supposed to be the easiest season. I know they lost 20 seniors from last year, but they still brought in a lot of talent and a lot of experience from last year's national championship team. This was supposed to be the easiest year for him. And then it was going to be, okay, how does he maintain talent acquisition and player development? This was supposed to be the easiest part for him, and it has gone up in flames. Michigan is staring down the barrel of a 6-6 football season, which coming into the season was their absolute floor. Their worst case scenario was a 6-6 season. If Sherrone Moore can't elevate them above their worst case scenario, then what are we keeping him around here for? Yes, their recruitment is looking a little bit more optimistic, but they need to have infrastructure in place for that to mean something. They need to have the right guys in the right chairs in order to bring in talent and make them impact players on the field. Just look at Texas A&M. They have been bringing in consistent top five recruiting classes for the better part of the past decade. And yet they're an afterthought when talking about the college football playoff and who the 10 best programs in the country are right now. So it's not always just bring in better players, become a better team. You need to have the infrastructure in place, and I'm not sure Sherrone Moore does. I think Sherrone Moore is simply unqualified to be the head coach, essentially the CEO of a program like Michigan. He's 38 years old. He is really young and doesn't have a whole lot of coaching experience outside of Michigan. Going from being the game day manager, essentially, for one of the best coaches in college football to then being the CEO for one of the most premier jobs in college football is such a step up. And I think it was a mistake for Michigan as a program and as a fan base to blindly ride with Sherrone Moore this offseason without even considering other options that were out there. Which brings us to our final question about this topic. If not Sherrone Moore, then who? There's four coaches of iMichigan. I'm calling them up right away, right at the conclusion of the season, and pretty much asking them to name their price. The first is Kurt Cignetti at Indiana. If he can do it at Indiana, you can bet your ass he'll be able to do it at Michigan. Dabo Swinney. I know this might be a controversial name, but it seems like Clemson fans are holding themselves at the standard of the 2015 to 2020 Clemson, when that really is not the reality anymore. And Dabo Swinney might like the idea of getting out of Death Valley and getting a breath of fresh air with a fan base that won't be breathing down his neck to win a national championship every season. Kyle Whittingham at Utah. They're having a down year in Utah. If there's ever an opportunity for a coach to walk away from a program he's been at for almost 20 years, now's the kind of season for that to take place. And then Josh Heupel at Tennessee. I think that his offensive scheme paired with Michigan's history of being a defensive line of scrimmage oriented program, I think that could be a really special combination. But even if you can't get one of those four guys, there's a lot of guys that I would still be interested in if I'm Michigan. Mike Gundy at Oklahoma State, Steve Spagnuolo, the Chiefs defensive coordinator, who's been doing incredible things at that level of football. Ben Johnson, the Lions offensive coordinator, Brian Flores, the Vikings defensive coordinator, Doug Peterson, who might be getting fired from the Jaguars, Pat Fitzgerald, who still hasn't taken a job after getting wrongfully terminated by Northwestern last year, Jeff Stoutland, Philadelphia Eagles offensive line coach. If you want to get back to that identity of mauling people a line of scrimmage, who not better than the architect of the best offensive line in the NFL? So, and that's just a few names off the top of my head. There are a lot of names out there that I think Michigan could get that would be really intriguing, that could elevate the outlook of this program. And the fact that there are so many names out there that I think would be good fits and who would be feasibly interested in a job like Michigan, because keep in mind, yeah, they're going to be 6-6 this year. This is still a top 10 job in college football. I think you could argue that it's the fourth best job in college football behind Ohio State, Alabama, and Texas. So the fact that there are so many names out there who I think could be an upgrade, and I think a lot of those names would be interested in, you know, a phone call from Michigan, makes the decision clear. If Michigan wants to get back into the college football playoff conversation anytime soon, it's better to rip the Band-Aid off now, bring in a new coach who can then build an entirely new coaching staff around him. So that's my two cents on Michigan. Moving over to the victor in that matchup this past weekend, Indiana. What a lot of people were wondering going into this game and what they were hoping to get answered from this game is Indiana for real? Because yes, undefeated is undefeated, and Indiana has earned every bit of the record that they have right now. But given how relatively easy their schedule has been, we wanted more answers to see just how good this Indiana team really is, and are they actually capable of upsetting a team like Ohio State? Are they actually capable of winning games in the college football playoff? And against the Michigan team that, yes, is down this year, but still, this Michigan team has more NFL players on it than anyone else Indiana has seen this year. This is a game that Michigan really needed if they wanted to keep the heat off of Sherrone Moore and his hot seat and elevate the optimism around the program a little bit. So this was a game that Michigan was taking seriously. It's still a very talented team. So this was the best glimpse we had into how good is Indiana really. So to start things off, I was really impressed with their defense. As impressed as you could be when you're facing a team like Michigan, who has as many offensive problems as any team in college football right now. To start the game off, Michigan actually had a really great first drive. Davis Warren knew where to get the football. I mentioned it before, Colston Loveland was lined up at wide receiver for a few plays, running routes like a wide receiver, had two catches on that drive, but then would come and help block inside. They had third and goal at the 3, looks like they're about to jump out to a 7-0 lead on the first possession of the game. And then from that moment, everything seemed to go poorly for their offense. Davis Warren dropped the ball on that third down. Looked like he slapped the ball a little bit as he was getting ready to wind up, and it just popped out of his hand. They recovered that fumble, had to settle for a field goal. And then, yeah, outside of that drive, Indiana dominated every facet of the game defensively. They shut down Michigan's run game, didn't let them get anything going on the ground. They didn't let Davis Warren get into a rhythm. They kept Colston Loveland out of the game outside of that first drive, and was really impressed with that defensive front. Aiden Fisher might be the best linebacker in all of college football. He is that leader of that defensive front. And then they have guys like CJ West on a really deep defensive line. They don't always show up on the stat sheet, but they did against Michigan what they do every week, and that's really just dominate the line of scrimmage. Really impressed with the defensive side of the football. I feel more confident in their ability to shut down the run game of a team like Penn State or Ohio State, who really leans on that run game to open up everything else in their offense. Offensively, it was a really great first half. Their offensive line gave clean pockets in that first half, which set up a lot of big plays in the passing game, gave them that 17-3 lead. Their wide receivers were showing out just how talented they are, winning one-on-one coverage across the board consistently. Curtis Rourke looked comfortable in the pocket. He was delivering really accurate footballs, knew where to go with the ball. And even though they never got the run game going, the offense looked to be in good shape. But then in that second half, the pocket started to collapse. Michigan started to win at the point of attack. They started to get pressure on Curtis Rourke. And from there, everything else around him just collapsed for this offense. And that's the problem with this offense. If the offensive line holds up and it gives Curtis Rourke clean 2-3 seconds to sit back, read the defense, and deliver a throw, it's a really difficult offense to defend because of how talented those pass catchers are. But Indiana's running backs are more quick hitters who are going to hit the gap and then make things happen in the open field. They don't really have a guy who can eat hits and pick up a tough 3 to 5 yards every time he touches the ball, even when the holes aren't there, just lower his shoulder. They don't really have a running game like that. The offense becomes overly reliant to use the pass game to then set up holes in that run game. But when Curtis Rourke doesn't have that clean pocket to pick defenses apart and keep them on their heels, everything else collapses because they don't have a lot of quick-hitting pass games and they don't have a run game to then lean back on and be like, okay, we can run the ball 5 straight times here and we know we can at least get a couple first downs. They are not really built like that. So you saw for the first time all season, when that point of attack breaks down, when Curtis Rourke doesn't have a clean pocket, this offense seems like they can be left without answers. And it doesn't help that Curtis Rourke isn't a really mobile guy that you can then incorporate the quarterback run to. Coming into this game, I think Indiana really did have an opportunity to blow the country away and prove that they are a national championship contender. Still think that they're a great team. Again, 10-0 is 10-0, and they are every bit of 10-0. They are a really great team. But they didn't do enough on Saturday for me to think that they can go up against a team like Ohio State, that they can walk into Columbus and pull off that upset. I think if they play a team like an Ohio State, like an Oregon, like an Alabama, I just don't think that this team is really capable of keeping up for four quarters, given how reliant they are on the passing game to then set up the run game. And it's also worth mentioning that, yeah, I love their defensive front and how they shut down Michigan's defense, but I still have questions about this secondary. And they won't be able to swarm the line of scrimmage and commit to shutting down the run game against a team like Ohio State, who you cannot just run man against across the board. You can't do that against Ohio State and expect to have success. They're going to have to commit more guys to dropping back in zone to take away some options in the passing game, which then it'll be interesting to see how well the defensive front holds up against an Ohio State running attack. In short, this is still a great team. Was really impressed with their win, but I'm not expecting Indiana to walk into Columbus and get a win by any means. I think they're still looking like an 11-1 college football playoff team who could beat a team like Miami or BYU or Colorado or Boise State. I think they could even give a team like Penn State or Notre Dame or Ole Miss a good game, but ultimately don't think that they're equipped to knock off a true national championship contender like an Oregon or Ohio State or Alabama. But I think that's what we thought coming into this game. Certainly no panic at all. They're 10-0. I think every Hoosier fan woke up on Sunday really happy, but they just didn't really seize the opportunity that they had to kind of plant their name as a real national championship contender. So finally, that's enough out of that Indiana-Michigan game. I wanted to talk quickly about a team that is surging in the Big Ten, and that is UCLA. They beat Iowa 20-17 at home to pick up their third straight win, and it looked like it was going to get dark early for UCLA. They had interceptions on their first two drives. They were about to give up a 75-yard drive to Iowa. Iowa had the ball on the UCLA 9-yard line. Looked like they were about to go up 14-0 at the end of the first quarter. But credit to UCLA, they held them to a field goal and then really dominated the game for the remaining three quarters. They held on for that 20-17 win, now moved to 4-5. Quarterback Ethan Garbers is finally starting to play really well. He's finally starting to show that kind of veteran presence that I expected out of him coming into the season. TJ Harden finally finding his rhythm in the run game after over these past two games. Wide receiver Logan Loya has really stepped up in some big moments. And Cade Medrano is probably the best defender that you've never heard of. You know, he's the leader of that UCLA defense at linebacker, a defense that held Caleb Johnson to 2.7 yards per carry, which is really impressive. Foster, their head coach, got off to a bad start going back to Big Ten Media Days, where he had that kind of lackadaisical intro that went viral on Twitter. And then they were sitting at 1-5, and I feel like the entire country just really wrote off UCLA after Indiana crushed them in week two. But if you look at some of those other losses in that 1-5 start, I mean, they were tied with LSU at halftime and only trailed them by 7 going into the fourth quarter before losing 34-17. They shut down Oregon in the second half of that game. They shut down Penn State's run game entirely in that 27-11 loss that they had on the road. And then they led by 10 against Minnesota at half before losing 21-17. So that 1-5 start wasn't quite as bad as everyone thought. And now they really are playing their best football. Three straight wins, and they finish with at Washington and at home games against USC and Fresno State. If you look at how UCLA is playing right now compared to Washington and USC, they are playing their best football of the season, and they could very well end up being the second best former Pac-12 team of the season once it's all said and done. Just considering where USC was standing after they pulled off that upset against LSU to start the season, and considering how bad of a start it was for UCLA, if we get to the end of the season and UCLA finishes above Washington and USC in the Big Ten standings, this is going to be very interesting, and really impressed with the job that Deshaun Foster has done at UCLA, and I think it could be a sign of more good things to come out of LA moving into 2025. And then one other team I wanted to touch on, their Week 11 performance, that was Penn State, who dominated Washington 35-6 in the whiteout. And I think, to be perfectly honest, it would have been really easy to overlook this game. That emotional letdown from the Ohio State loss the week before would have made sense. And then if you have a game you're not entirely feeling up to, and then walking into the whiteout could be really daunting. Yes, that whiteout is your home crowd. They're supposed to have your back. But you feel that pressure, even if it's the home team, and you feel the need to live up to the hype that's around you. So if you walk into a game that you're just not really feeling up to, and then you feel that added pressure from the crowd on top of it, I think it would have been fairly easy for them to find themselves in a deficit, especially going up against a team like Washington, who has a veteran quarterback like Will Rogers, who's playing the best football in his career, and they have playmakers on both sides of the ball who can generate some big plays that can swing the game in their direction. But to Penn State's credit, they showed up and dominated from start to finish for really the first time all season. They scored a touchdown on all four first half possessions to go up 28-0 at halftime. They outgained Washington on the day 486 to 193, almost 300 yards different. They held Washington to 2 yards per carry and 4 of 13 on third down, ultimately winning 35-6. The defense really showed how great they can be. I think just like Ohio State's loss to Oregon triggered something for that defense, and Ohio State's poor performance in the run game against Nebraska kind of triggered something for that offensive line, I think Penn State's loss to Ohio State, particularly the way that Ohio State ran the ball all over this defense to end the game, might have triggered something in this Penn State defensive front. They had 5 sacks and 9 TFLs on the day, and they played with a different fire than I had really seen so far to this point. And they finished the season with at Purdue, at Minnesota, and Maryland to close the season, so really like their chances to go 11-1, get a home college football playoff game. And considering they don't have the biggest challenges on their schedule to finish up the season, they could be really rested going into a home college football playoff game based off of how tight they played Ohio State and how they responded to such a tough loss. I think that Penn State could be dangerous. Really good showing by Penn State, and that had to be an encouraging performance for Penn State fans as you shift your focus now on who are we going to be playing in the first round of the college football playoff and where will that game be. That being said, I did hate the fact that I had to watch that game back afterwards and couldn't watch it live because it was on Peacock. And I'm going to get into a little bit of an old man yells at the sky rant here, but I think Saturday was a perfect example of how these big media companies like Fox and NBC are starting to ruin college football and what fans love about it. Peacock's college football presentation is downright horrible. I think every fan that's been forced to watch a college football game on Peacock would agree. Every game I've seen on Peacock has been a really tough watch to get through. Every aspect, you know, from the pregame coverage to the announcing to the way the camera angles and how they manage replays, really everything is just flat out bad about Peacock's college football presentation. And then NBC got the rights to Penn State's whiteout and they decide to throw it on Peacock because it's not a great matchup and they want to drive some viewership to that platform that virtually no one watches, but then gives the whiteout, the Penn State whiteout, one of the greatest spectacles that we get to see in college football every year. That happens once a year. They give that whiteout the same treatment as any other game. It was the same terrible Peacock presentation, and it was just really disappointing, I think, for Penn State fans and for any other fan that wanted to tune into the once a year whiteout. And I think it's sad enough that Penn State's whiteout is resorted to a game like hosting 5-4 Washington because of Big Noon kickoff and their mandate to make any decent Big Ten game they can get their paws on to go on that noon slot. You know, that's forced Penn State to now resort their whiteout to a game like Washington. But now the actual TV presentation of that game is, you know, sucks too. So it was a really big shame to see the fall from grace for the Penn State whiteout. You would usually see it on primetime, ESPN hosting a top 25, top 10 team like Ohio State, and now they're hosting a 5-4 team over on Peacock. Just really disappointing. And while I'm on this rant, I might as well give Fox a little bit of a dig too, because I saw a tweet trying to illustrate that Big Noon has been a really good thing for fan bases, saying that it was a tweet that said over the last 25 years of Ohio State versus Penn State games, the Big Noon games have 9.4 million viewers. All other Penn State Ohio State games have averaged 7.3 million views. And they use that as justification to be like, look, Big Noon is great. More people watch at noon. It's been good for viewership. Therefore, it's been good for fans. That is just so far from the case. Because I think in order to evaluate whether or not noon kickoffs are actually valuable, I think you have to more so compare other top five matchups this season to that Big Noon matchup of Ohio State versus Penn State. So yeah, Ohio State versus Penn State got 9.5 million viewers. Georgia versus Alabama, which was at night, 12 million. Texas versus Georgia, 12.9 million. Even Alabama versus Tennessee, which was a 3:30 kick, got 10.7 million. And you can argue those are SEC teams. They have a bigger fan base. They'll watch more. Okay, how about Texas versus Michigan? That was a Big Noon kickoff. 9.3 million. It doesn't take a data analyst to realize that the primetime games at 7, 8 o'clock Eastern time get more views than noon. And if you want some more statistics to illustrate this, of the 25 highest watched games from the first half of this season, only 6 were noon games and only 2 were on Fox. So there's no question to me that noon generates less viewership than a night game does. So I don't hate all noon games. Like, I love the fact that Ohio State Michigan is at noon every year. That's part of the rivalry and part of the tradition. But Joel said during his broadcast of the Ohio State Purdue game that Indiana and Ohio State will be a noon kickoff as well. That means in the 14 weeks of the college football regular season, 6 big noons will be at Ohio State games, including 5 of the last 6 weeks. So like I said, I don't hate all noon games, but when it delivers a bad product, like we saw with Ohio State Purdue, that's when I get a little annoyed, because there are so many good college football games on Saturday. Instead, Fox stuck the voices of college football, Gus Johnson and Joel Klatt, in Columbus to cover the number 2 team in the country against 1-7 Purdue. And unsurprisingly, Gus and Joel did not seem very up for the game. They were quiet, brought no energy the entire game. Gus Johnson, who usually can't help but scream at outrageous plays, was pretty much just talking monotone through the entire game. So I don't blame them for being maybe a little upset that they have to cover this game, and the fact that they're covering Ohio State 5 of the final 6 weeks of the season, I understand that they'll be a little maybe Buckeye wary, but it's really disappointing, because having the voices of college football covering a game as bad as Ohio State Purdue on one hand, and also hearing them be as bland and as uninspiring as they were, is really a disservice to fans. I kind of hate myself for acting like I'm surprised over all of this, but we are really starting to see the impact that media companies like Fox and NBC and ESPN competing with each other and using each school and their viewership as a dollar sign rather than an actual fan base that has culture and passion and feelings. You know, we're seeing the impact of that now. And that's why I'm really scared about, you know, the future of college football and what an expanded playoff could do, because I think expanding the playoff beyond 12 teams seems inevitable at this point, and they won't do it to produce a better product of college football. They'll do it because it'll generate more revenue. And it doesn't take a college football genius to realize there are not 15 or more great teams in college football every year. You're seeing that play out this year with the fields. I think there are 12, maybe 13 really good teams. But once you get outside the top 12, you're looking at teams like SMU and Army and Clemson and Texas A&M and teams that I really don't think are national championship worthy. And that's in 2024, which seems like a deeper year than usual. And I think if you expand the playoff, you're just going to water down the playoff, make some really bad matchups, and then make the regular season really meaningless, because teams like Ohio State and Georgia can go 9-3 and still make the playoff. Saturday was a big moment of reckoning for me, because I realized what these media companies have done to the sport that we love and how little they really care about the fan bases. I think in the fact that they've pretty much discarded the whiteout to Peacock, and teams like Ohio State won't have a home night game the entire season. I don't know the next time Ohio State will be able to host a night game because of these media rights deals. Hate to go on a little rant about something that, you know, that no one can really control at this point in time, but feel like it needed to be said, because it was really disappointing to see the Penn State whiteout on Peacock, and it was really disappointing to hear Gus Johnson and Joel Klatt be as uninspired as they were during their broadcast of the Ohio State Purdue game. With that being said, we can now dive into our final little segment of this episode, and that's a little bit more college football playoff talk. So with Indiana's win over Michigan, and I'm assuming they'll be able to beat Purdue at the end of the season, I think it is all but secure that the Big Ten is going to get 4 teams in the playoff. Oregon, Ohio State, Penn State, and Indiana. Barring a huge upset, those 4 teams seem locked in. Notre Dame, another team that is playing their best football of the year. They look like they're on pace for an 11-1 season, which will be an easy ticket punch to the college football playoff. It is worth saying that they do play Army on a neutral field. Army could really create chaos for this entire playoff if they pulled off that upset. I'm not going to break down the implications of Army beating them, because based off of how both teams are playing right now and based on how Notre Dame handled Navy when they played earlier this season, I really do expect Notre Dame to pull out with that win. So we can evaluate the implications of an Army win if and when that happens. But for now, we're going to slot in Notre Dame into the playoff. So that's five teams, I think, all but locked up. And then Boise State seems like the obvious group of 5 team that will make it. So that's 6 teams. I think the ACC, now with Miami dropping a game against Georgia Tech in the regular season, I have a really hard time conjuring up any sort of scenarios where the ACC can get more than one team in. So I'm going to slot in the ACC champ as the seventh spot and then the Big 12 champ as the eighth spot. The Big 12 still has an outside chance of getting two teams in if BYU runs the table, goes 12-0, and then loses in the conference championship. There's a chance that BYU could still make it in as an at-large team. But given what's going on in the SEC, I'm having a harder and harder time figuring out a way where how BYU can stay in. So for now, we're going to go with Oregon, Ohio State, Penn State, Indiana, Notre Dame, Boise State, the ACC champ, let's call it Miami, and the Big 12 champ, let's call it BYU, has eight spots in the playoff, pretty secured, which again means we got four teams left for the SEC. And I broke down a scenario last week where we could end up with six 10-2 SEC teams, and it could be absolute chaos. I wrote that off saying, I don't think that'll happen, but Ole Miss beating Georgia makes that scenario that I outlined last week a little bit more likely. So again, right now, the six SEC teams that are contending for, we presume, four spots in the playoff are 8-1 Texas, 8-1 Tennessee, 7-2 Alabama, 7-2 Georgia, 8-2 Ole Miss, and 7-2 Texas A&M. I think if Alabama and Ole Miss win out, because they both have those wins over Georgia, I think if they win out, they will be locked into the playoff. No worries at all. That leaves Texas, Tennessee, Georgia, and Texas A&M battling for two more spots. And the more I think about it, I think that Texas-Texas A&M game at the end of the regular season is going to be a college football playoff elimination game, which is crazy to think considering that Texas is still considered by many one of the frontrunners for the national championship, and they should be in the top five of the latest college football playoff rankings coming up tomorrow. But if you look closer at their schedule, there really isn't anything impressive on it because they had two top 25 wins in the first half of the season. That was Michigan and Oklahoma. Those were a couple of 6-6 football teams. So nowhere near as impressive as we thought they were in the moment. They got dominated at home against Georgia, a Georgia team who now has two losses and is not playing very good football right now. They have a really tight win over Vanderbilt, who just lost to South Carolina for, I believe, their fourth loss of the season. And they're finishing with Arkansas and Kentucky before that Texas A&M game. So if they lose to Texas A&M, I don't really see a win on this schedule that you can point to and be like, no, Texas really is that good. They deserve to be in. And then Texas A&M, if they lose, that would be their third loss. I think that definitely knocks them out. So I really think that Texas-Texas A&M at the end of the season is going to be a college football playoff elimination game. So then we have Alabama and Ole Miss and the winner of Texas-Texas A&M as three of the four SEC teams. So that means it's between Tennessee and Georgia for that fourth spot, and they're playing this weekend, which means we might have another college football elimination game on our hands when Georgia plays Tennessee. So that's how I see the playoff shaking out right now. You have Oregon, Ohio State, Penn State, and Indiana from the Big Ten. You have Notre Dame as another at-large. You have Boise State out of the Mountain West. I still think Miami is going to win the ACC. I think BYU is still going to win the Big 12. And then I'm going to have Alabama, Ole Miss, the winner of Tennessee, Georgia this weekend, and the winner of Texas, Texas A&M at the end of the regular season. I think those are your 12 playoff teams. And I can't wait to talk about the playoff next week and see how wrong I am once one of these teams get upset this coming weekend. So that should be a lot of fun. But it's just very cool to see. No one knew how this 12-team playoff would shake out coming into the season. But week by week, we're starting to get a little bit more clarity. And I think we are starting to see the line in the sand being drawn. And I think it's starting to become easier to see how this playoff is going to shake out. But great news for the Big Ten, barring a monumental upset. Really think that we are locked in with four teams. But again, if Penn State were to lose to a team like at Minnesota, if Ohio State were to fall at home to Michigan for a fourth straight season this year, that could open up a lot more scenarios where now more of these six SEC teams are where the SEC could get more than four teams in, or the Big 12 could get an additional team in. But one last scenario I wanted to talk through before signing off today centers around Boise State, because I saw a tweet earlier that was just simply asking what happens if Boise State loses the Mountain West Championship. And that's a scenario that for whatever reason never really crossed my mind. Boise State will most likely be playing either Colorado State or UNLV in the Mountain West Championship. Those teams are 6-3 and 7-2 respectively. I think Both Colorado State and UNLV will have a really hard time getting into the college football playoff top 25 before that Mountain West championship. So if I'm being honest, if Boise State loses that game, I don't think whoever they lose to is going to take their spot. I think the most likely scenario is that the American Athletic Conference takes that other bid, whether it's Army or Tulane or Navy. I would expect the American Athletic Conference to take that fifth conference title spot. But another thing worth considering, is there a possibility Boise State could lose that Mountain West championship but still make it in as an at-large team? And I don't think so. If Army were to upset Notre Dame, they would need to hope the ACC and the Big 12 still only get one team in, and they would have to hope that they stay above a 10-2 Tennessee, for example, which I really don't see happening. There is somewhat of a path if a lot of upsets happen, but frankly, I don't see a realistic scenario where Boise State can lose the Mountain West championship and still make it in. That being said, I do think Boise State can lose a regular season game and still stay ahead of the American Athletic champion. So there is that. Don't see a scenario where Boise State can lose the Mountain West championship and still make it in as an at-large team. But with all that being said, that'll do it for this episode of the Big Ten Blitz. As always, I've been your host, Sean. Really appreciate everyone and anyone that's out there listening. We have another great weekend of Big Ten football and college football as a whole this coming weekend. One of the final weekends of college football we have this season, so hope everyone listening gets an opportunity to sit back, and relax, and enjoy another great day of football. Please make sure that you are following us on Twitter at TheFloorSlap and check out our website, TheFloorSlap.com, where we're posting articles every week. This has been the Big Ten Blitz, and I will be sure to catch you here next week. Thanks.